Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. It is 1:30. We're in the Senate Finance Committee meeting. Present Senator Stedman, Senator Olson, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. We have three items on the agenda. The first is Senate Bill 140, Fire Station Grant Program by Senator Stedman. Invite Senator Stedman and or his staff to the table to introduce the bill. We have Margot.
Youngberg.
Huh?
Youngberg.
Youngberg?
Youngberg, yeah.
Okay. Youngberg.
Close.
To the table. Please introduce yourself and tell us what the bill does.
Margot Youngberg, staff to Senator Stedman. SB 140 is an absolute, In our state, it is an absolute necessity that firefighters across Alaska have functional facilities to ensure that they can respond to emergencies swiftly and safely. Regrettably, numerous fire stations in the state are in critical need of repairs and modernization. Investing in these fire stations means supporting the dedicated individuals who consistently stand by our communities during times of our greatest need. Many stations are nearing the end of their useful lives, and each one serves an essential role in protecting their communities. Each new year brings innovation in technology and updates to best station design practices coupled with regular wear and tear from daily use, and it is inevitable that existing fire stations eventually become outdated. SB 140 establishes a matching grant program that provides funding for up to 50% of the total project cost for constructing or renovating fire stations. This program would follow the structure of other successful infrastructure investment programs already established in our state. One notable example is the Harbor Matching Grant Program, which has awarded approximately $118 million to 57 harbor projects over the past two decades. A decade ago, the legislature appropriated substantial funding to construct or replace a dozen fire stations across Alaska, and that, to date, is one of the most highly popular capital budget items. And that, in brief, is what the bill would do.
Question, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. I think this is your first bill.
Actually, I had one honoring the Energy Council last year.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. The honorarium. Okay, but the first real bill. So, you did very well, by the way. So let me add a little bit. There's a couple slides that show some fire halls that were constructed. And when I look back in the history of my tenure, along with the colleagues here at the table, years ago we had a healthy revenue stream and we funded fire halls around the state, several of them. The one on the screen in back of us is up in Nikiski. There's several more slides showing different, in your packet, showing different fire halls around. But it's one of the most popular capital projects we've ever done. The energy program that we did years ago to upgrade homes all over the state, I'd say that was probably our number one. And I would say this is getting right up there. And when we look at the need for fire halls, they're very expensive. They do get outdated. And there's quite a few of them that need to be replaced. There is no intent of putting this program in place this capital year. It has a zero fiscal note. What we're trying to do is put the program in that would allow then communities to submit applications for the grants, and then they'd get ranked just like the Harbor Matching Grant Fund, and then we'd have the discussion here at the table how much money we want to put in. And by having it independently ranked, we take the politics off the table as far as, you know, what fire hall gets built. And the 50% came from the Harbor Matching Grant Fund. We talked about this with libraries, did something similar. But it seemed to be a very popular way of doing it. And the fire halls that we built have been extremely popular. They don't target one particular geographical area, one, you know, political group, or anything like that. It's for everybody in the community. So, Mr. Chairman, that's in essence what this bill does.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Do members of the committee have questions of the prime sponsor or testifier? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To whoever, whichever wants to answer it, looks like this is in the Department of Commerce. Would you have them rank these fire halls, or would you have public safety, where the fire marshal is, rank them? Who would do the prioritization?
I would think it would not be the fire marshal. It would be the department, and right there, and they may, quite frankly, be a little late, if I can guess how some of the departments work, writing that until such time as they see the highly probable appropriation hitting the table. But I think they can work on that. That's why it doesn't have much of a fiscal note or anything. So it's just the shell program.
Senator
but I don't
Keel.
Think it would be the fire marshal.
Senator Keel?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was curious about whose expertise we were going to use.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Thank you, Margot. We will go to invited testimony. The first individual that we have signed up that has been invited is the immediate past president of Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, Forrest Kuiper. Please come forward. Is he here in person or online?
Online.
Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, councilors, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Paul Piper, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association and a strong, unified support of Senate Bill 140. I serve as the fire chief of the University Fire Department in Fairfax. The Alaska Fire Chiefs Association represents fire service leaders from every region of our state, from urban, rural, road system, remote, volunteer, combination, and career departments. SB 140 reflects something powerful and important, holistic statewide support for Alaska's emergency services infrastructure. This bill is not about one department. It is not about one region. It is about Alaska. Across our state, fire stations are aging beyond their useful life. Some were built in the 1960s. Many no longer meet seismic standards, cancer prevention best practices, decontamination requirements, or ADA compliance requirements. Others were built for a different era, before modern apparatus sizes, before advanced EMS delivery, and before today's training and response demands. SB 140 addresses two critical needs. First, replacement and new construction where facilities are no longer viable. Renovation is not always possible. In many communities, full replacement is the only responsible option. This need also reflects growing communities that need new stations to effectively meet the need of those communities. Second, infrastructure upgrade. Ensuring our stations are safe, resilient, and capable of housing modern firefighting and EMS equipment. The total need identified by the Alaska Chiefs exceeds $347 million for new construction and $22 million for renovations. That number may seem large, but it reflects decades of deferred maintenance and the reality of Alaska's construction environment. Fire stations are not optional infrastructure. They are critical response hubs. They house emergency medical services, disaster response capability, wildfire response assets, community resilience operations. They protect homes, schools, businesses, industry, and in many cases, the economic engines of our communities. Investing in fire engines is investing in life safety. It is investing in faster response times. It is investing in firefighter health and cancer prevention. It is investing in public safety readiness statewide.
SB 140 represents a thoughtful partnership between the legislature and local governments with the 50% local match. It recognizes that while communities are doing everything they can locally, the scale of need requires state partnership. On behalf of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, I respectfully ask for the passing of SB 140. This bill strengthens emergency services capability across Alaska and ensures we can continue protecting our communities today for generations to come. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chief Kuiper. We will go north to Kotzebue and hear from Tristan Ferguson with the Kotzebue Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Mr. Ferguson, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair, Senate Finance Committee members, for inviting me to testify Senate Bill 140 today. My name is Tristan Ferguson. I'm the fire chief for the Northwest Arctic Borough in Kotzebue. I'm speaking today in favor of Senate Bill 140 on behalf of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Just like past President Horst stated, it's an effort for the whole state of Alaska. My region in Northwest Arctic is a facility that was built in the early 80s. It had four additions on the station, and it is in need of crucial upgrades to be compliant and have more safety factors in for the response of the community and the responders. The Northwest Arctic Borough is home to over 7,000 people, and it is laid out across 40,000 square miles in Alaska. I oversee 10 villages in my region. We do not have fire stations in these villages. Rather, we have warm storage facilities that has ATVs, fire trailers, and fire equipment. We believe that Senate Bill 140 would be beneficial to not only my region, but to the rest of the state of Alaska. At this time, I appreciate your time and consideration. If you have any questions, I can answer them. Thanks.
Thank you for that. We'll open public hearing at this time. We go to Anchorage, Alaska. Douglas Schrage, the fire chief for the Anchorage Fire Department. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. This is Doug Schrage. I am the fire chief for the Anchorage Fire Department in the municipality of Anchorage. I also am a past president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, and I speak in strong support, along with my other colleagues, of Senate Bill 140. And I thank the primary sponsor, Co-Chair Stedman, for bringing this bill forward for consideration. In my role with the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association and in the positions I've held in fire departments in the interior and in South Central, I'm pretty well acquainted with some of the needs in communities throughout Alaska. In Anchorage, we are fortunate that most of the fire stations that we staff and occupy are modern, well-equipped facilities, but we've had difficulty adding new stations. The municipality has added a net increase of one new fire station in the entire history of the municipality when it was first formed in 1976. I'm aware of communities such as Gustavus. This last week, the Alaska Fire Chiefs met in Juneau to talk about our concerns and our needs, including Senate Bill 140. And I got to know the interim fire chief for the Gustavus Fire Department. This is a community of between 425 and 650, he told me, depending on how you count. And their fire station has been added onto multiple times, and the original building is held together with wooden pegs. And with a tax base as small as the community of Gustavus, it would be hard to conceive how that community could afford to bring a bond proposition that would pay for a new public safety building. I think Senate Bill 140 provides a path for communities, large and small, to combine their own fundraising efforts with assistance from the state in this grant program. And I look forward to its passage, and if I can help in any way, I would be glad to. Thank you again for the time in considering this bill and taking my testimony.
Thank you, Chief Schrage. We'll go to Ketchikan, and we will hear from Steve Ryden, the president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Testimony, please.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Steve Rydeen. I'm the fire chief for South Tongass Fire Department in the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, and I also serve as the current president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I'm speaking today in favor of Senate Bill 140 on behalf of the fire chiefs and of our local community. My department has two stations. 30 personnel, 25 of them are volunteer, 5 are paid. We serve 3,100 residents in my district, but we work very closely with the city of Ketchikan, which is approximately 8,000 people, and the north end of the town, which is another 3,500. We provide fire suppression, EMS, rescue, special confined space rescue, trench rescue, and other elements of the fire service. Our stations, we have two stations in this community. Station 2 in the city of Ketchikan was built in 1974 and is in need of updates. Station 5 in the city of Saxman was built in 1965, and it needs to be replaced. The city of Saxman is a community of approximately 465 people, don't have the resources to come up with the funding to build a new fire station or public safety station, for that matter. We look for grants and opportunities to assist our small communities, just like Gus Davis can't afford it because of their size. Cloaca is the same way. We have a number of southeast communities that don't have the ability to go out for bond for public safety buildings or fire stations down here in southeast. So I am in support of Senate Bill 140, and I thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'm open.
Thank you, Mr. Rydeen. Seeing no questions, Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Just for a brief comment, I got involved with building fire stations almost 25 years ago here, say just 20. South Tongass and Ketchikan was the first one. They came in, needed a new fire station. The fire chief at the time had no idea how the system worked, and so we worked through the legislative process. It took a couple years, and the state helped build a fire station there. And then several years later, we had strong financial revenue, and the state, through the capital budget, helped build well over half a dozen or more. I'd have to go back and get the list, quite a few around the state. And then 2 years ago, for just entertainment, we're finishing up the capital budget, and the original fire station in Ketchikan, South Tongass, caught on fire. So I just thought I'd mention that. You know, you've been around here long enough when you see a project constructed and then it catches on fire several years later, and it was the fire hall. So anyway, they got that under control and saved that fire station, and that started the conversation how could we move fire halls forward around the state, and should we put in a program to make it fair so you know, all the communities have access to it, and that was the impetus of this particular piece of legislation, Mr. Chairman. I just think it's was one of the best capital project items we've built over the years, and I just think we should move forward when we have the revenue to do more of them.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Is there anyone in the audience that's wanting to testify on Senate Bill 40? Is there anyone online?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Before you set this bill aside for further review, could we ask the Senate President to come forward? I see him in the audience, and find out what he's going to do this weekend.
Who is that?
Senator Stevens.
Oh, he's going to testify on another bill.
No, he's going to testify on this. He doesn't know yet.
Mr. President, Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to welcome Senate President to the table. I'd like to know his opinion on this bill and where he's planning on going this weekend and for what purpose.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, Senator Hoffman, Senator Gary Stevens Kodiak. So I am going home this week, this weekend, for Saturday, a dedication of a new fire station in Kodiak. And just so you know how that was achieved over a period of years, I believe something like $15 million was put in by the state of Alaska, by you, another $7 million by the federal government, another $2 million by the local community. It was the lion's share came from the state of Alaska, and I am totally appreciate all of the efforts you've done in making sure that comes true. So it's a beautiful building. Have not been inside it yet. It just opened up, and they'll have the dedication on Saturday.
Thank you for that testimony. Make sure you have fire extinguishers in the place. Is there anyone online? With that, we'll close the public hearing and then go to Senator Keel for review of the fiscal note.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one fiscal note submitted by the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development's Division of Community and Regional Affairs. It creates a new fund, which will never show up on Senator Kaufman's list of moribund funds. The fiscal note calls for $10,000 UGF one time only in FY26.
Any questions on the fiscal note? Seeing none, we'll set this bill aside.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just wanted to ask the bill sponsor if you'd consider an amendment to have a specification for fireproof fire stations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity. I think the architects will be very careful to try to make sure that the fire hall doesn't catch on fire, because when it's embarrassing when that happens, and it does once in a while, but it's embarrassing.
Thank you for that. We'll set this bill aside and take a brief at ease.
On the record, I've got to stand in for the chairman today for a little bit. Next up is Senate Bill 23, Civics Education. This is the first hearing on this bill. I'd like to go ahead and invite Senator Stevens and his trustee staff, Tim Lampkin, to come forward to the table and introduce Senate Bill 23. And when you're ready, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and introduce us to the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gary Stevens, Kodiak. A lesson learned, never walk into finance when you don't know what you're going to be expected to do. But, I appreciate your hearing Senate Bill 23, Civics Education. So there has been a quiet epidemic in this country of apathy and division for decades. We've had a focus in our schools, and it's important, on math and science, reading and writing, but that has been at the expense of social studies. And Senate Bill 23 is an effort among many that are needed to help restore faith and understanding of our system of government by our younger generations. The bill calls for the creation of a civics curriculum and creates a required exam or completion of a course on civics for graduating seniors. It's not a high-stakes test. It is a high-stakes issue, but not a high-stakes test. It tasks our Board of Education Early Development to develop curriculum and assistance for school districts to align our education with those civic standards. And with this bill, we hope to rekindle a spirit within our education system for helping foster citizenship, voting, community engagement, which is the fundamental purpose of our public education system. It is also a purpose consistent with our founding fathers, with their vision of an education system intended to create good citizens within our republic. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to end very briefly with a quotation from General Washington, President Washington, George Washington. In 1796, 20 years after the Declaration of Independence, Washington gave his farewell address. I'm sure you've all read it at one time. But what he said, two sentences, sort of on a high level, maybe a little difficult, but I know you'll all understand him. Washington said this to American, the citizens of America: "Promote then, as an object of primary importance, institutions for the general diffusion of knowledge. In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened." Great, amazing words from George Washington. It is essential that public opinion should be enlightened. Coming soon, on July 4th of 2026, we're going to be commemorating our 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, historic milestone, reflection on those principles which really define American democracy, and also echo George Washington's enduring call for civic enlightenment. It's still even more urgent today to expand and strengthen civic education for our children.
Okay. Any questions, initial questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, I'd like to go ahead and go to invited testimony, and we'll start up in the Kenai Peninsula with Alex Copland. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, this is Alex Copland. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So I'm from Homer, and Alex Copland's my name. I represent Kenai Peninsula Boats, and I want to thank the Senate Finance Committee today for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 23, Civics Education in Alaska Schools, sponsored by Senator Stevens and Senator Greg Jackson. I was asked to testify today for a couple of reasons. One reason is the work Kenai Peninsula Votes, KPV, is done on the Southern Kenai Peninsula. I've been a member since it began in 2016. We began with the idea to increase voter turnout and voter education. As we say, we want everyone to vote, but just as importantly, be educated about what you are voting on. Just don't ask your uncle or aunt who to vote for on election day. Voting takes work. It's not easy. KPV has held numerous events to educate the public about elections and civics. We have worked in the public schools and the local college here. In 2023, with the help of Amy Galloway, who is now retired and taught history at West Valley and Fairbanks, the Homer High School students held a Kenai Peninsula mayoral candidate forum at the high school. Over 300 students attended, and it was completely run by students. Rupert Parsley, the teacher in charge, was steadfast in ensuring the students were fully in control of every facet of the forum. Afterwards, the students were so proud of themselves, they won't forget that experience. The other reason I was asked is that I'm a nerd about civics. I use the word nerd in a positive light. I'm always taken by JFK's speech when he said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Now I want to address SB 23. First and foremost, I want to acknowledge that it is critical for all our students to have civics classes. and even more so should start in kindergarten and go through all 12 grades. I taught government in high school in Homer. To graduate from KPBSD, you must earn a half a credit in government and a half a credit in AK studies. The curricula for those two classes align well with Part B of the sectional analysis for SB 23. Given my experience in teaching high school government and AK studies, I am curious how many school districts require the government class. In other words, if all 55 districts are already doing this, do we need to address this portion of the bill? On this bill, I am advocating for a project-based assessment. I am not entirely sure it aligns with the language in Section A of the sectional analysis, but within my scope, a hands-on civics project would be mandatory to pass civics. I already mentioned a Homer High School student who ran a Mayo candidate form. There are many more project-based assessments that could be easily identified and required. This would not require any additional funds. It could be as simple as attending the local city council meeting and writing a paper on what they learned. Other examples of project-based assignments include a letter to the editor, drafting a bill, testifying on a bill as I'm doing today. A program that we push here on the peninsula is the Youth Voter Vote Ambassador Program, and this is all throughout the whole state, where 16-year-olds and up can work at a polling station and get paid too. Doing hands-on projects will give students a better understanding of civics and how they can be directly impacted. Reading, writing, and math are the foundations of learning, but when you are learning those subjects, you need content, and learning civics while studying reading, writing, and math is critical. KPV fully supports civic education in school and support SB 22. I believe we are already doing this in many of our school districts, but having students complete a project that goes beyond the facts can instill a lifelong understanding and can help students make their homes even better places to live. I leave you with this quote from John Glenn. By its very definition, civic responsibility means taking a healthy role in the life of one's community. That means that classroom lessons should be complemented by work outside the classroom. Service learning does just that, tying community service to academic learning. I want to thank you for your time today, and if you have any questions, I'm here. Okay. But thank you for the service you guys do, too.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to Molly McCammon, board member of the Alaska Historical Society.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Molly McCammon. I live in Anchorage, and I am testifying as a board member of the Alaska Historical Society, which is Alaska's largest and only statewide historical organization dedicated to the preservation and promotion of our state's history. I speak on behalf of the more than 400-plus members of the society and express our enthusiastic support for Senate Bill 23, an act relating to civics education, civics assessments, and secondary school graduation requirements, which is now in your committee. The Alaska Historical Society has long been concerned about the lack of civil discourse among Alaskans. And in response to that, we've sponsored over the past several years a series of public lectures to promote civic discourse on a variety of topics, whether it be sovereignty or auto development or subsistence or any other kind of topics. But the lack of civility, however, can also be traced to the poor condition of civics education in Alaska. And so preparing young people for active citizenship and engagement in our democracy is increasingly important as the challenges we face at the local, national, and global levels become increasingly complex. I think requiring core government and civics education at the high school level and passage of a civics assessment like that required by naturalized immigrants or a comparable civics project assessment would go a long way towards helping young Alaskans prepare for their place as active citizens. In fact, if there was some way to require this for Alaskans of all ages, we would enthusiastically support that as well, as we all need frequent refreshers on the core principles included in documents such as the Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, the U.S. Constitution, and our Bill of Rights. And so as we approach the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which Senator Stevens referenced, a well-educated citizenship is more important than ever. And with young people now beginning to vote at the age of 18, now is the time to make sure they're prepared for future community engagement. So the Historical Society really encourages you strongly to vote to approve this important piece of legislation, and if possible, get it enacted before July 4th, 2026. Thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, Dr. Sean Healy.
Hey. Good afternoon. My name is Sean Healy. I am the Chief Policy and Advocacy Officer at an organization called iCivics. We are Sandra Day O'Connor's legacy organization. As you may know, when she retired from the Supreme Court, she had a deep concern about the state of civic knowledge in the country. And as my predecessors in this testimony have stated, civic knowledge isn't passed through the gene pool. It has to be cultivated with each successive generation. So she founded our organization for that purpose, and we are the leading civics curriculum provider in the country, but also do policy work to support stronger civic education policy at both the state and the federal level. So I'm speaking to you today in that capacity, and just to reiterate what my colleagues have testified already, a comprehensive civic education is vital for developing the civic knowledge, skills, attitudes, and behaviors that are necessary for lifelong informed engagement in our constitutional democracy, and especially in this, our 250th year. We have put forth a policy menu as we make recommendations to states. What does a comprehensive civic education look like? One, we recommend dedicated instructional time in civics. That means a course in high school. We also think there should be a course in middle school and instructional time in K-5. We know, for example, from national test data, the NAEP civics test, known as the Nation's Report Card, that students that take a standalone class in civics do about 10% better on the test, and that's pretty phenomenal in education circles. Civics, it's also important to have civics embedded in state standards. Assessment is critical, as a couple of my colleagues here have attested to. We also think that students in schools should be recognized for excellence in civics, which I know this bill addresses. It's important that teachers have professional learning opportunities in civics to both build their content knowledge and also their pedagogical skills. And it's critical that civics be funded as other subject areas are. So how's the country doing and how's Alaska doing with respect to these recommendations? As of 2025, 37 states have a standalone high school class in civics. 7 of them are doing it for a full year. Of course, Alaska is not one of those states, but this bill would change that. Only 5 states have a standalone middle school class. However, 47 states require instruction in civics in the middle grades. That includes Alaska. 29 states have a form of civics assessment. Most are doing some version of the U.S. naturalization test, which this bill, of course, calls for. But some states have alternative forms of assessment, like a project-based component, also referenced in this bill. In terms of recognition programs, 19 states either recognize students, teachers, or schools for excellence in civics. That's really a growing area. Alaska is not doing that. 44 states, including Alaska, provide professional learning opportunities for teachers in the realm of civics through their state agency, and 16 states provide dedicated appropriations for civics. Alaska is not among them. So to conclude, we are not sentenced to the current predicament that we are experiencing nationally, where there are low levels of civic knowledge, where there's historic distrust of our institutions and of one another, and of course, toxic political polarization. States across the country, including Alaska, are embracing civic learning as an antidote to strengthening and sustaining our constitutional democracy. Just in the last 5 years, 33 states have adopted at least 50 policies to strengthen civic education. I'm hopeful that Alaska will be that 34th state to join the roster. And just this spring, we're tracking 172 bills in 37 states that aim to address civic education. By our measure, 115 of them, including Senate Bill 23, would strengthen civic education.
Okay.
In closing, as my colleague has suggested, we are nearing our 250th celebration on July 4th. And if you think about it, a young person that's in kindergarten right now will graduate kindergarten this coming spring / summer, and we'll celebrate that 250th. We'll shoot off fireworks for them fall ships in our harbors. That same young person that's in kindergartner will actually graduate high school in the year 2038. And that's the year we'll celebrate the 250th anniversary of the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. And I think it's a challenge to all of us in policy circles. What will we have done to invest in this rising generation and to make sure that this grand experiment in democracy is carried forth to the next generation? I think this bill, Senate Bill 23, is a huge step in that direction for Alaska. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Dr. Hilly. That concludes the invited testimony. I'd like to go ahead and open up the public testimony. Teresa Obermeyer from Anchorage.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Teresa Obermeyer calling from Anchorage. It's so great to see Senator Olson here, but I at the table, because I know you've been sick, Dr. Olson, and I'm so glad you're feeling better. I'm a longtime resident of Anchorage, Alaska. I represent a family of 14 that live in Anchorage, 8 of whom are voters and 6 children. I mention this because we care. I focused on, and I sent you not only to the Senate Finance Committee, but to individual senators, my interest in civic education, which should include the whole continuum, starting with American legal education, going to undergraduate college education, definitely high school and elementary and middle school. I've been on the Anchorage School Board, and I certainly care about civic education. I refer you specifically. See, you might say, well, why don't you speak to the Senate and the House Judiciary Committee? They have not really been willing to hear me. And it is time, ladies and gentlemen, for something fair for all of us. I'm mainly focused on the Alaska Bench and Bar. I don't know whether any of you know that all the other 49 states have elected office holders who are required to be members of their respective bar associations. Alaska does not. We have no elected representative who are a statewide officer who is required to be a member of the Alaska Bar Association. I find this appalling that this could still be going on. Since statehood, nothing seems to ever change. And the other thing is that I assume you know, but I'm not sure you've ever thought about it, that we live in the only state in the United States that does not have an American Bar Association accredited law school. This makes our state so very different, and it makes for sure how important civic education is to the future of Alaska. I hope you know that in our Alaska Constitution, Article 13, Section 1, it is required that all amendments to the Constitution have to be approved by 2/3 of each house of the Alaska legislature. You see, ladies and gentlemen, I consider that almost insurmountable unless you help me. And let me also add that even to have an initiative petition, 18 states allow initiative petitions without having to go before their legislatures. We have such a difficult hurdle in order to get a constitutional change. But I hope you will read Senate Joint Resolution 21. And it had been introduced by Senator Gray Jackson in 2020. We certainly need American legal education. Please. You know what I really thought was a fun idea, Senator Stevens and Senator Hoffman? Since you are retiring, why don't you introduce the bill?
So
your swan song. That would be such a good
Obermeyer, could you please finish up?
Your career.
Can you please finish up, please? We're going over time.
That's all I have to say. Lastly, is I have two Facebook groups. One is Elect Alaska Attorney General 2026, but 26 is going on, and we haven't even gotten a bill introduced. Okay. And then the other one is Alaska Permanent Fund Board Confirmation Committee. I have just posted finally.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Obermeyer. Thank you for your testimony. Yes, thank you for your testimony. And let the record note that Ms. Obermeyer supports this bill from many angles. Anybody in the room that would like to come forward and speak on this bill, please? For or against? Seeing nobody else is on the list. That will conclude then the public testimony. Senator Keel, for the review of the fiscal note, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 23 has a single fiscal note. It is from the Department of Education and Early Development, Student and School Achievement Allocation. It is a fiscal note of unrestricted general funds for the first year cost of $837.1 and one permanent full-time position. That cost drops in the out years to $179.1 until year five when it goes back up.
Thank you. Senator Keel, that fiscal note sounds a little padded. We'll have to take a look at that. But, any further comments from committee members? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I was just looking at the list of your resources, and I was just wondering, have you had any interface with the education community around their willingness to use those in general?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Senator Kaufman, yes, we've been talking a lot to teachers and former teachers. As you know, Mr. Copeland that spoke first was a former teacher. And I should just address that one issue that he brought up, that his district is doing education, civics education already, and that's true. Some of our districts are. Not all of them are, though, and this would bring some consistency throughout the state that all districts have to consider this. But, yes, in fact, I'll turn it over to Tim Lampkin if he can maybe give you some further information on who he's been talking to.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, for the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. That list that you're referring to is just a small sample set. There are the teaching community, Mr. Copeland in particular, is aware that these resources exist, that they're out there, they're freely available, not just the curriculum, but even down to lesson plans.
Okay. Other questions before we closing comments from the bill's sponsor before we set this bill aside?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So important issues came up. One is to realize that some districts are doing just a fine job in the state, but not all are, so it needs to be statewide. I really appreciate the comments from the gentleman from iCivics. They've done a great job of bringing us all into up to date on what's going on. The immigration test was talked about, and as you may recall, Senator, I passed that test out a few years ago on the Senate floor and promised that if anyone would fill it out, I would grade it and get it back to them, and nobody did. But, you know, the problem is that people think it's an all-or-nothing test. You have to get all 100 questions right. That's not true at all. 70% is what we're looking for. And I took it myself several times, and the nice thing about it is you can take it as often as you want, and you can learn something from every time you take it. And so that by the time you get through taking it, anybody with a simple rationale of American government will be able to get 70%. Teresa Omar, I think she was saying that we should have the State House and State Senate members pass that test. That's not in this bill, believe me.
Okay, thank you. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, SJR 2, constitutional amendment. Votes needed to veto override. This is the first hearing on this resolution. Invited is Senator Klayman and staff support. To the table to introduce SJR 2. Please introduce yourself for the record, along with Carly Dennison. And we'll have invited testimony. We'll have you up, Mr. Bertello, here in a little bit. I know you're excited about coming and seeing us, but it'll just be a few minutes.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Matt Klayman, State Senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage. Thank you for hearing Senate Joint Resolution 2. Senate Joint Resolution 2 proposes an important change to our state constitution to improve our public's ability to influence executive and legislative decisions on revenue and appropriations matters. It would ask Alaska voters to amend Article 2, Section 16 of our Constitution to lower the override requirements for revenue and appropriation vetoes from three-quarters of the legislature sitting in joint session, or 45 votes, to two-thirds, or 40 votes. In recent years, former legislators John Coghill as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee and Jonathan Christ Tompkins both introduced identical resolutions in the House and the Senate. Alaska has the highest requirements for overriding revenue or appropriations veto of any state. Only one other state, Arizona, even comes close to this override requirement, and Arizona only requires it for revenue bills, not appropriations. The other 48 states all have lower override requirements for revenue and appropriation bills. Most states require a two-thirds vote from both legislative chambers to override a gubernatorial veto. Seven states require a three-fifths vote, and six states only require a simple majority. Few states differentiate between vetoed revenue and appropriations items and typical policy bills. The three-quarter vote requirement makes it extremely difficult for the legislature to override a revenue or appropriations veto. Since statehood, the legislature has only overridden appropriation vetoes five times and only twice since 1987. The three-quarter requirement also creates a difficult double standard for revenue and appropriations legislation to pass the governor. A typical policy bill, although it might contain a fiscal note, requires a two-thirds vote to override if it receives a governor's veto. If that override vote succeeds, the governor may then use his line item veto to remove funding for the bill from the budget. That line item veto then requires a three-quarter vote to pass. We saw this dynamic unfold last year when the governor vetoed House Bill 57 in May. The legislature met quickly and vetoed that with the required two-thirds override. And then the governor vetoed the education funding from the budget. To override that, we needed 45 votes to override the veto. Lowering the revenue and appropriations requirement to two-thirds will align the requirements for all vetoed legislation and eliminate what I think has become a bit of a double standard. In crafting our Constitution, Alaska's framers established a strong governor form of government. This structure is evident when looking at the three-quarters legislative vote requirement to override fiscal legislation and the governor's right to select the Attorney General. When Alaska was a young state, the idea of a strong governor made sense. Today, we are no longer a young state, at least if we don't compare ourselves to the 13 colonies. Our economy has grown, and public participation in the political process has increased substantially. This amendment returns more power to all Alaskans and their elected representatives and senators, and it will establish a better balance between the governor and the legislature. If two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate approve SJR 2, it will appear on the general election ballot for voters to decide in November, and it is not the subject of a governor's veto to appear on the ballot. And that's all I have.
We have any initial questions before we go to invited testimony for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Klayman. I'd like to go ahead and invite the former Alaska Attorney General, Bruce Bertello, forward.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I look forward to providing some perspective relates to my previous role as Attorney General.
And you are? What?
Bruce Botello,
okay,
last name, B-O-T-E-L-H-O. I'm representing myself. Just to do a brief history lesson, as it were, it seems particularly appropriate in light of the previous bill, to simply note that the power of the executive to veto has a very long tradition. It comes initially from Roman times. In the colonial period, the veto power was exercised by the royally appointed governors, or the monarchy itself was free to veto any measure that a colonial parliament legislature would enact. And this, in fact, was one of the grievances that's actually included in the Declaration of Independence, the monarch's use in the words of our members of the Continental Congress, abuse of power in blocking what were considered fair and just laws. As a result of that, the first states and in forming constitutions provided not only for the executive power to veto, but we have the origins of the veto override. The first three states proposed in each a two-thirds majority to require be able to override a veto. And that has actually become the norm. As Senator Klayman pointed out, every state has a provision for veto overrides, and the vast majority actually provide for a two-thirds vote. I want to note we're talking about the 250th anniversary on July 4th of U.S. independence, but there was another anniversary last Friday, and that was the final day of the Alaska Constitutional Convention on February 7th of 1956. And it embodied at that point the provisions both for the power of veto, but the veto override. And that brings us to the question of the choice that the framers put together to provide for two classes of veto override, the two-thirds for every provision except those dealing specifically with appropriations, the three-quarter vote. The reasoning reflected in the minutes of the Constitution suggests that the primary driver here was the importance of having a very strong executive. And that's replete throughout the convention proceedings in terms of making sure, for example, that there was a single chief executive, that the departments would be responsive to the governor able to remove commissioners, for example. One exception that was specifically carved out was the Department of Education, which was to be run by a board, and the idea there was to make sure that education was not political. It was a nice aspiration in any event. And the other that was left up in the air was actually the issue. We had a board of fisheries, we had a board of game, and we also had a department of fisheries and game, and it was left to the first legislature to decide who would actually be the head of the department. And so those are the two anomalies. But another feature in terms of this strong executive was the line item veto, which is also today included in most constitutions. And that brings us then to the three-quarter vote. What was the reasoning? There does not seem to be any deep reflection other than the idea of a strong executive. There was no other state that had considered and adopted the three-quarter provision. In fact, as Senator Klayman noted, we have today 36 states that use the two-thirds majority formula for all bills, seven that require a three-fifths, to say 60%, and six states that only require a majority vote. It was not a result of anything that happened in territorial days. The Organic Act of 1912, which created the Alaska legislature, provided that vetoes could be overridden by two-thirds vote. Interestingly, and it was a choice that our legislature or our framers could have made but chose not to, was the two-thirds was required from each house, as opposed to what is unique here in Alaska is that it be required in joint session. The only reference that I can find anywhere to the concept of a barrier of three-quarters is a debate at the U.S. Constitutional Convention where Alexander Hamilton, representing New York, advocated that the overriding of a presidential veto be a three-quarters vote, and it was soundly rejected. So, again, what we have is framers who were not looking to any previous experience with the veto number, simply settling on the idea that we had to have a strong executive. My suggestion, and I think based in part, again, on Senator Klayman's observations about the veto power, if we look at state history, Dr. Gordon Harrison has actually looked at all the vetoes since statehood. There have been 475 through 2024, so we can overlook last year or add it to. Of those, only 100 were challenged. 50 of those were overridden, and almost all of them had nothing to do with appropriations. What it says is that there is a, I suspect, what I would describe as an imbalance in the respective powers of the legislature and the executive, particularly with regard to appropriations. Outcome is that the executive has extraordinary power over the purse, a prerogative that is in our Constitution, as in virtually all other states, the prerogative of the legislature to decide as representatives of the people how money should be appropriated. And to the extent that this power of veto and the inability to override really distorts, in my view, the idea of the legislature being a co-equal branch, and particularly the risk when one can see partisan-driven or policy-driven vetoes that are controlled by a relative minority able to block the will of a supermajority. I think it is somewhat ironic that it takes a three-quarter vote to override the governor's veto. And this, in a slightly different context, it only takes two-thirds vote of the legislature to actually propose an amendment to the Constitution. And I think in terms of weighting value, while obviously the budget bill is the most important single function you have, and it's the one single action you must take, that power, I think, is unduly restricted to the extent that it would take as has been the case historically, the three-quarter vote, which is almost never successful. Those conclude my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. So that concludes our invited testimony. I'd like to go ahead and open it up for public testimony. Is there anybody in the audience? There's nobody online. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to come forward and testify? Any other claimants in the audience that want to come forward and testify? Seeing nobody else in the audience wants to come forward, I'll go ahead and close. Oh, excuse me. I didn't push the right button here on my screen. There is online. So we'll go to the online testimony. Please, we have a two-minute limit. So we'll start with Ms. Teresa Obermeyer from Anchorage. Ms. Obermeyer.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for hearing me. Would you forgive me? I feel such sadness that as I look at Matt Klayman and Bruce Patel, ladies and gentlemen, they are wolves in sheepskin. I say that to their faces. I am so darn apologetic. I am a judge's daughter from St. Louis, Missouri, and I grew up in a courthouse. I come from a family of attorneys. I know decency, and I know that my family and I should never have been put through the things we have in Alaska.
Miss Obermeyer.
That man is trying to get elected governor off of it.
Miss Obermeyer, Miss Obermeyer, we need to keep the comments to Senate Joint Resolution Number 2 dealing with the constitutional amendment, please.
Yes, and it really is like my comments about civic education. Of course I support them, but we have to look beyond this. And I want to say lastly, and forgive me always, our constitutional forefathers, the delegates to our constitutional assembly, they did not get it right about lawyers. I apologize. And I'm trying to just tell you, we have to create a brighter future. So if anyone had a question, I'd be glad to field them. But you're very patient to hear me, and I hope it's a good meeting. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Obermeyer. I don't see anybody else online, and I do apologize for not pushing the right tab on my iPad here. I would have picked that up if we had someone waiting. So I'll go back. There's been new people come into the room, so we will, in the era of inclusion, we'll go back and open up the public testimony from the room. Anybody wants to testify on SJR 2, constitutional amendment? Now is your chance from the audience. Okay, seeing nobody coming forward, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. We'll come back for the review of the fiscal note by Senator Keel. Senator Keel, could you help the committee, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Joint Resolution 2 has a pair of fiscal notes. The first is from the legislature under the legislative operating budget for session expenses. That is a zero fiscal note. The second is from the Office of the Governor, the Division of Elections. They also submit a zero fiscal note. That concludes them.
Thank you, Senator Keel. We have any final questions, comments from any committee members? I'd like to go back to the resolution sponsor, Senator Klayman, for final comments before we set this resolution aside for further review.
No comments. Thank you for hearing the resolution today.
Okay. Thank you for everybody coming in on a busy afternoon and testifying on an extremely important issue and balancing the powers of government. So that will conclude this action on this resolution today. We'll set this aside for further review. That actually concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We're going to get an update on Mount Edgecombe High School, what's the goings-on there. We've had four of our members travel there last week, take a look at it. We'll be having some discussion on the capital needs and physical infrastructure, along with the health and well-being of the students at Mount Edgecombe High School. 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. We are adjourned at 2:37 p.m.